We had a 9-0 decision from the Supreme Court recently about the TikTok decision. And I think anytime anyone sees 9-0, they go, oh my gosh, how that never happens. I do want to dispel that notion. 9-0 decisions are actually, I think, probably, they may not be the majority of cases these days, but they are what we would call the mode. They're the most common result. Right. And I actually was looking this up, and our guest probably knows more about this. I should just turn him on in a moment, and I will. And he can tell me if I'm absolutely off base here. But I was looking, and one article I saw was from the 2022 term. 59 decisions were made, and 48% of them were unanimous decisions by the court. I imagine that ebbs and flows. And again, it may not be the majority of decisions, but we got another 9-0 decision out of this court. Hear about the TikTok case. I just wanted to add a little context to that. Perhaps University of Illinois law professor Jason Mazzone will have a little more for me. But professor, welcome to the program. We got a lot to cover, but there are a lot of 9-0 decisions, aren't there?
Hi, John, and happy new year to you.
You too.
And we're jumping right into some important legal issues. You are right. There are a lot of 9-0 decisions. It's about half, of the decisions that come out of the court, and so your observation is absolutely correct. We tend to think the court is highly fractured, 5-4, 6-3, something like that. But actually, in a good number of cases, they agree on the outcome.
Isn't that somewhat satisfying, maybe isn't the right word, reassuring? I think that, yes, that it is reassuring that the court's legitimacy is withheld or is kept up by, of course, there are decisions that are flatly incorrect or correct, 9-0.
Yeah, I think that's right. It does show that there's a significant degree of cooperation among the justices, and so we shouldn't just focus on the smaller number of cases in which there are really sharp divisions.
Right. Not that those aren't often decisions that drive people crazy one way or the other,
right,
and we can dive into that. But yeah, I just wanted to point that out. I'm glad we got that. So we have this 9-0 decision essentially saying that the Congress is authorized to, they had that law that the president signed that they could disband TikTok if they didn't divest this Chinese-owned company to an American company. The Biden administration sued to kind of keep that the case. And they ruled 9-0 that that is the case. I know there's a lot of complications here, but my first question is, how is this not a First Amendment violation, Professor? It says Congress shall make no laws. People use TikTok to, speak. How is this not a First Amendment violation?
Right. And it took the court, I think, a little while to figure out what exactly the First Amendment problem is in the case that TikTok was asserting. So, I mean, here's how you think about it. I mean, the government in the case is not directly regulating speech. I mean, it's focused on the harvesting of data that it's concerned about from a national security perspective. It doesn't really matter to the government what TikTok is doing, what speech it involves, or even if it involves speech at all. If you had a platform that wasn't about speech, involved in online sales or something like that, and it was harvesting data with the risk of it being transferred to the Chinese government, then I think the government would say, yeah, that's equally problematic. So from one perspective, you think, well, where is the speech that's being curtailed here? But then as you sort of reflect a little more, and I think this is your instinct, John, 170 million Americans in the United States use TikTok to communicate, right? It's sort of one of the most valued forms of communication that exists. And if it shuts down, as it sounds as though it might do tomorrow, then there is a real impact on expression, a real burden. Not every burden on speech is a violation of the First Amendment. There are some circumstances in which the government can set forth a sufficient justification to burden speech. And here the court, 9-0, as you observed, was persuaded that the government's interest in shielding Americans from mass harvesting of data it looked as though it would quite easily be transmitted to the Chinese government was a sufficient justification to to override the First Amendment interests that the court itself recognized.
In a day and age, though, where we're all using apps to communicate, and some people, as you mentioned, whether it's TikTok or another app, that is their mode of communication, social media. This is their this is their marketplace of ideas, are the apps that they use. Then is it because it's a foreign? I mean, like, who's to say? Yes. I mean, we all give up data to private billionaires. They may be American and American companies, but that comes with its own risks. And
so notice, you know, Congress does not. It has been described as a TikTok ban, but Congress is not actually banning TikTok. It's just insisting that relationship of the parent company to the Chinese government not be in place anymore if TikTok is going to operate in the United States. So, you know, Congress doesn't, as I said, you know, it's fully supportive of this form of communication. It's the data piece that it's concerned about. And if the company is therefore, you know, sold off to an American interest and that risk of transfer of massive amounts of data to the Chinese government is severed, then, you know, life will go on as usual.
I don't know. I mean, at first I was totally with this 9-0 decision. The more I think about it, I find some issues that I have with the precedents that this sets. It is essentially swayed by a 9-0. The court was essentially swayed by the argument that China is harvesting our data. There are companies that are owned by other countries or owned in other countries that are maybe seen more friendly to us, where they absolutely are harvesting our data. But we don't have a problem with that because they're, quote unquote, an ally of ours. Should the court really be making?
Yeah, so throughout the opinion, there's lots of mention of this being a foreign adversary, right? That does seem to be important to the court, and the court also is careful in the decision to say that this is a decision that is really limited to this specific entity and the particular risks that the government has identified, given the size of the TikTok platform and the relationship between the parent company and the Chinese government and the amount of data at risk. And don't think, therefore, that this same logic would necessarily lead to us upholding other sorts of laws that apply to other kinds of entities where, you know, maybe the risk is not as large, or maybe who's doing the harvesting doesn't present the same sorts of national security concerns that the government had emphasized in this case.
So they're saying that this is not a ruling saying that Congress can now outlaw Spotify. No. Spotify is owned by a Swedish company. We are in NATO with Swedish. The court might rule, nope, that's okay, or that's not okay. You can't.
The court is very clear to say that all it's deciding is the First Amendment issue with respect to TikTok. And as you rightly point out, once you start looking and thinking about other sorts of entities that might themselves be collecting significant amounts of data, there's no, you know, automatic reason to think that the same logic would apply. So it was a sort of confluence of factors specific to TikTok itself that led the court to uphold the law.
I mean, Telegram is owned by a Russian company, and we are actively giving weapon systems to an adversary of Russia. I mean, why hasn't Congress acted on that? I guess if they did,
maybe
the court.
Will, right? So maybe after this one, it will. There were, you know, before this decision, I think there was a lot of debate about the ability of the government, Congress, to do this sort of thing. But, you know, with this decision on the books, maybe Congress will start looking around and thinking about other entities as well.
Yeah, I always, this is a blanket statement, so feel free to take this how you want. I know courts sometimes say that they are not creating a precedent by specifically saying those magical words of this is specifically geared towards this one. But can the Supreme Court accidentally create a precedent or do one unintentionally?
Sure, and you know, in any sort of future statute, it's going to be litigated initially in the lower courts, and lower courts are bound by Supreme Court precedent. They don't like to be overturned, and so the inclination of a lower court, I think, would be to start with this TikTok decision and say, well, the court did say that it's particular to this case, but the logic might well apply to this other context as well. So there is always that kind of risk that once you have something on the books that it sort of guides the analysis of lower courts and then maybe the Supreme Court at the end of the day in the future.
Yeah, I think precedent can become prescient. You know what I mean?
Right.
That you can use that line in your courses. I just came up with it, if you want.
That's great.
Someone probably already said that. That's where I stole it from, Professor. Someone pointed out on the text line, and I kind of agree that this is a curious case. The 217, the better question is why the Biden administration, in theory, tomorrow, when this goes into effect, is just not going to enforce it for a day. I know we've had other laws, like I think about prohibition and the struggle the executive branch had in actually enforcing what was a new constitutional amendment. And in those days, you had, you know, a wide ignoring of the law of the land. When I think about the federal designation of marijuana and cannabis and the decisions not to enforce it. Does that make things a little hairy for you that the executive branch can go, I know it's a law, but I'm not going to touch it?
Well, the difference is the timing. I mean, TikTok is sort of sandwiched between these two administrations. And so the Biden administration, in order for it to enforce the law, TikTok would have to, still be operational in the United States tomorrow, and Google and Apple and all the platforms and apps distributing it, and then you have to start compiling your criminal case. But you can't get any of that done before noon on Monday when the new administration comes into office. And so there's really no practical way that the Biden administration could enforce this by way of fines that are provided for in the statute before the Trump administration itself takes office. And then I think the big question for TikTok is going to be, what is the Trump administration going to do? It could certainly, and you mentioned the sort of decisions not to enforce certain marijuana laws, it could certainly take that model and say, we're not going to enforce this. We're going to wait and sort of see how things play out down the road, and maybe some arrangement can be put in place. That is the view that Trump has expressed in the past. But for TikTok, you do have this risk of continuing to operate tomorrow, and then perhaps the new administration saying, no, we actually want to fully enforce this, and you're suddenly liable for everything that you did on Sunday. The statute provides for civil fines of several thousand dollars for every single TikTok user. Once you start adding that up, that's going to, it'd be a very significant penalty if you're willing to risk it. So it's a very odd position for TikTok to be in, and a sort of strangely structured law that takes effect the day before a new administration arrives.
Yeah. So I think what you're driving at here is that the Biden administration, whether they said they were going to enforce it or not, the mechanism in which enforcement happens, it takes time. And so they could say whatever they want. I'm going to enforce this or not. It doesn't matter. Right. 24 hours later, he's out of office. And by then, it doesn't matter. So I guess what you're saying is it's all for naught. The Biden administration can say or do whatever they want. It's not going to matter come 24 hours later.
Yeah, as TikTok has said, we're going to go dark, that will leave a lot of Americans a lot of time on their hands.
We got Professor Jason Mazzon from the University of Illinois Law School, and just to set this up for everybody, in 1971, the U.S. House of Representatives voted in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment, a proposed amendment to the Constitution that would explicitly prohibit sex discrimination. In 1972, the Senate passed it, which sent it to the legislatures. 38 states' legislatures needed to approve it, 3/4. And the amendment, when it was passed by the Congresses, unlike previous amendments, there was a deadline associated with it of 7 years. 35 states ratified that amendment before that deadline, but it wasn't enough. 3 more have ratified since, including Virginia in 2020. The president yesterday said, yep, it's the 28th Amendment. I don't buy into the argument that a deadline itself imposed on the amendment was constitutional. So it's left us in a little murky water. First of all, before I ask my question, Professor, did I sum that up correctly?
You did. You missed one small thing,
okay.
Which is that when it became clear when the initial deadline was expiring that there were not going to be enough states, Congress said you have another 3 years. So there was that change as well. No additional states came on board during that additional 3-year period.
Okay. So they made it 10 years, essentially. No one bit at the apple. Nevada did it in 2017, Illinois in 18, Virginia in 2020. So, Professor, are there 27 amendments or 28?
I am of the view that there are only 27. I have not heard very good arguments for why there are 28. I did see President Biden's announcement on his way out the door virtually yesterday that he believes that the amendment has been validly ratified. That doesn't change, I think, the facts, and it doesn't change the law. It doesn't change the law because the president has no role in the amendment process, as you described. It's only Congress and the states that play a role. And I think, you know, the view of most constitutional scholars, though not all, is that you can't count those three states that you mentioned that had decided in favor after the congressional deadline had expired. And then the other sort of problem is that when Congress said you have another 3 years, states, so extending the deadline out for 10 years, you had several states, I think five states, that rescinded their prior ratifications. That was Nebraska, Tennessee, Idaho, Kentucky, and South Dakota. And so it seems to me if you're willing to say, well, once it leaves Congress, it's in the hands of the states, and this is the principal argument that the Biden camp is making, then the deadline is no longer of any effect, and the states can ratify. It's up to them. I think you also have to be willing to say at the same time, well, if it's in the hands of the states, then the states should be permitted to rescind, certainly before the deadline that Congress imposed has lapsed.
That's interesting.
And so I don't see how you get to 38 if you count the three that you mentioned, Nevada, Illinois, and Virginia, after 2017, but also count the five, as I think you must, that rescinded before the deadline itself had expired.
That's interesting. So yeah, the camp that's,
if you got to start over.
Yeah, if the camp that believes that deadline is arbitrary and in fact a deadline may be unconstitutional for amendments, they are ignoring the fact that you would still need at one point 38 states all at the same time to be rowing in the same direction, which you
I think that's the key point. I mean, if we want a constitutional amendment, it is a high bar. It is difficult to amend the U.S. Constitution, but there is that deep principle that we want a simultaneous consensus. And, you know, maybe it's across a period of years, but at least you still want consensus. And if some states have said no, then I don't think they're in the boat that you're rowing.
Yeah. Interesting that the 27th Amendment, which you and I both believe, and most, I think, people do, that is the final one, was originally like one of the first ones. It just wasn't ratified until 1992, but they didn't have a deadline on it. I know
there was
been
no deadline.
There was no deadline. Some people have been arguing that, well, why would Congress be allowed to put a deadline in the original Constitution? They don't arbitrate whether there should be deadlines or not. My only counter to that is, we don't exist in a world in which the federal government, how it operated on day one, was the limit of rules and regulations. Those things changed throughout the years. It's as malleable as the document itself.
And you might also say that you know, Congress is part of the process of amending the Constitution. You need two-thirds of both houses of Congress. And it seems to me perfectly consistent with Congress's role for Congress to say that we are in favor of this amendment if it is indeed approved by the requisite number of states within a certain time period.
Right.
I don't see any problem with Congress putting that sort of contingency on its own approval.
Absolutely. And by the way, before we get any text messages, Professor Mazzoni and I were not making any value judgments about the amendment itself, simply looking at the black and white issue of whether it is an amendment or not. I imagine you'd echo that sentiment, sir.
I certainly would.
Yes, exactly. Just before anyone gets upset. Professor, it has been a thrill to chat with you again. As always, you bring such guidance to us on all things amendments, all amendments, all 27 of them, and potential 28. But you always highlight the first one so eloquently. And I think you've actually formed a lot of my opinions on the First Amendment in our conversations on this program over the years. And I thank you for that.
It's always a pleasure. So I look forward to our next conversation.
And it will be soon, I'm sure. That's Professor Jason Mazzone, who I always struggle to say his name correctly, even though I know it's Italian, I should say it correctly. Professor Mazzone of the University of Illinois Law School. Great stuff there.